I do think in the next 5 years, you're going to get a laptop and a phone and a headset, whether it's for training purposes, whether it's for collaboration. That headset is now going to be an integral tool to how you do your job.
But what is reality? Asked the gnome-like man. He gestured at the tall banks of buildings that loomed around Central Park, with their countless windows glowing like the cave fires of a city of Cro-Magnon people. All is dream, all is illusion. I am your vision, as you are mine. This is the opening paragraph of the 1930s short story Pygmalion Spectacles, written by sci-fi author Stanley G. Weinbaum. Weinbaum's tale features a pair of goggles that let the wearer experience a fictional world through holographics, smell, taste, and touch. This story was the first comprehensive description of a technology that transports the user to a new, artificial, and virtual reality. Over the years, this concept would become commonplace in sci-fi stories, and over the following century, it would become a reality. Today, VR headsets, goggles, glasses, and contact lenses are all coming to market. They all might not be ready for prime time, but in the case of virtual reality, it's here and it's ready. One technologist that's helped pioneering virtual reality and helping it become mainstream is Derek Belch, CEO and co-founder of Striver. In the past, Derek lived for football. He was a student of the game that played at Stanford. One day, while roaming the grounds of campus, he discovered virtual reality and a professor that had been studying it there for decades. Derek was hooked and became intrigued about the idea about how virtual reality could be used to improve athletes' performance. This curiosity turned into a business venture, and one of Derek's mentors from Stanford provided a small initial investment to help him get started. A new company was born called Striver. Striver was born of the mindset that a virtual world could not only improve an athlete's ability, but also provide valuable insights through data. Today, Striver works with more than 20 NFL and NBA franchises, but the platform has extended beyond professional sports, and now private sector clients like Walmart are beginning to reap the benefits of immersive learning. Immersive learning is way more than content that's just put inside a headset. It provides realistic, high-impact experiences that train workers in a way that some simulations just can't do. Derek joins me on today's show and details his tough decision to leave football behind and embark on a grander mission. You'll learn how Striver is setting the standard when it comes to immersive learning, how it's creating a new category, and allowing employees to train and learn by doing rather than watching. Immersive learning is the future of work, and it's here now, hidden in plain sight.
This season of Hidden in Plain Sight is brought to you exclusively by our friends at Splunk, the data to everything platform. Splunk helps organizations worldwide turn data into doing. It's time for data to be more than a record of what happened. It's time to make things happen. Learn more at splunk.com or by clicking the link in our show notes.
Derek, welcome to the show.
Chad, thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
I'm excited to talk to you. There's a lot that we could dive into, but I think before we start, I would love to just hear, who are you and what do you do? Please tell our listeners.
Sure. Yeah. So my name is Derek Belch. I am the founder and CEO of Striver. We are almost 6 years old. We were founded in January of 2015. I'm sure we'll get into more detail here in a minute, but to keep it simple, we use virtual reality for employee training. We started in sports and then eventually made our way over to the enterprise. And today we are the leading startup in a very, very new and fast growing space, powering immersive learning, virtual reality across many companies in the Fortune 1000.
Very cool. And when it comes to immersive learning, could you kind of unpack that a little bit for some listeners that might not be as familiar with it?
Sure. So this is still a relatively new term. We are trying to do our best to establish the rules, norms, diction as it relates to everything here. So we define immersive learning as an experiential training methodology that combines the sense of presence of virtual reality with advanced learning theory, data science, and spatial design. Now, while that is the technical definition that we're trying to get out into the world consistently, colloquially, bottom line, when people put virtual reality headsets on their faces, they treat the virtual world like they treat real life, as far as how they think, what they do, et cetera. So, immersive learning is immersing you in a learning by doing experience. And hoping that, you know, the learning outcome will be better than what you would otherwise do on a PowerPoint, a video, a lecture, et cetera.
For sure. And I think, you know, in these socially distanced times, it's something that is much, much needed. And arguably, you know, even past these times, it's something that we've kind of been craving, but we didn't know we were missing it. So what was the first like aha moment where you discovered, okay, this is not just a need, but it's something that we need to get out quickly. And there are enterprises and customers that are like ravenous for this.
Yeah. So I think this goes back to our sports days. So when I founded the company in 2015, I was coming off of 2 years as a coach, football coach at Stanford University. And my master's thesis was to come up with a way to train football players using virtual reality. Well, I showed the academic project, which was little more than a demo, right? It was certainly wasn't a piece of software that could scale. I showed that to probably outside of the players on the team, half a dozen to a dozen, you know, NFL general managers, other coaches, you know, et cetera, that came through Stanford's office over the course of the year. And the jaw-dropping reaction that each of them had to what they saw in that headset, where they're standing in a football office in Palo Alto, and they feel like they are on the practice field. I will never forget to this day and beyond, you know, how some of these coaches and players reacted the first time they saw this. Well, flash forward to 2016, mid 2016, 18 months into our journey at Striver. And I get a phone call from Walmart and they said, "Hey, we've seen what you've done in sports. We'd love for you to come down and show us what we could do for employee training." So I go down there pretty much on a whim and, you know, Chad, to directly answer your question, a roundabout way of getting there. The aha moment was when these Walmart executives put on the headset and go through football plays and they're laughing, they're having fun. They're like, "Oh my God, this is amazing. Here are the 50 ways we can do this here at Walmart." And I just start peppering them with questions. How do you train people? Where do you train them? Why do you train them? What are your pain points? You know, walk me through this, right? And I'm sitting there just taking notes voraciously. I'm just me and eight other people and on the Walmart side. And I'm like thinking to myself, "Oh my God, this is identical to what happens in sports." The only difference being the actual content that's going to show up in the headset, right? A football play versus a Walmart store. So that was my aha moment. I mean, I pretty much decided right then and there that we were going to pivot the company to be much more of an enterprise play. And then here we are in 2020. You already said this, that we're in the middle of a global pandemic, remote work, you know, all of these different things that are influencing why virtual reality may actually accelerate even further in the enterprise, which is, you know, super, super exciting.
Really exciting. Yeah. And congratulations on getting in there and, you know, so early. I think that's the fascinating part for me is, you know, I want to know, how did you settle on that as a master thesis? Obviously, it's a market that's growing. You know, was it Ready Player One? Was it a little bit of, you know, from conversations? Was there a mentor involved? Or is just this like a combination of everything? How did that unfold?
Yeah. So for my advisor on the thesis, Jeremy Bailenson, who is a professor at Stanford, runs the virtual reality lab there. He's been there for almost 20 years. That was Ready Player One for him because that was his life. he is a professor at Stanford. This is what he teaches for a living. This has been his area of academic interest for 30 years, going back to his UC Santa Barbara days. And so when I was coaching at Stanford, fully dead set on being a football coach. But I had to do a master's thesis and, you know, so I wanted to pick something that I thought would be interesting. Well, Jeremy and I were sitting, you know, and talking about what I could do. And I was like, "Okay, is there any chance to do something that actually would apply to what I'm doing on the sports side, to coaching?" And Jeremy's like, "Well, remember when you were an undergrad and, you know, you would ask me, 'Hey, could VR be good for training athletes?'" And I was like, "Yeah, but maybe one day, you know," and this is 10 years ago or 10 years before, excuse me. He's like, this is 2014 when we're talking about this. He's like, "You know what? I think the technology will be ready to go in like a matter of months based on, you know, Facebook buying Oculus and all these other things," right? And so we just thought about, you know, put our heads together and said, what about trying to come up with a way to train football players using VR? And I said, yeah, sure. Sounds cool. So that's literally how this thing started, as a fun and obviously, you know, academically sound project. Something that I was doing while I'd be coaching football that maybe could help the team get better. You know, the head coach of Stanford, David Shaw, was all ears. Obviously I had an academic requirement to fulfill, but also he's like, yeah, if this could help our team improve, then great. I'm all for it. So that is how it started, literally. And then, you know, 9-10 months later, David Shaw literally sits me down and is like, hey, if I were you, I'd get the heck out of here and go start a company. So, I mean, I think I'm the one of the only people to get fired with a non-severance check for $30,000 because David Shaw asked if he could invest in the company. And, you know, he didn't really fire me, sure, but he said, hey, get out of here. I'd love to give you a check if you'd be willing to take my money. So that's it. That's the genesis here.
So cool. And it's a great reminder about the power of Stanford and the, you know, the place we're in the Valley that has that type of mindset, right? That is, you know, always scanning the horizon, looking for opportunities for students and professors to collaborate. I'm so excited that that exists in the world. When you were coaching and you had your heart set on becoming a coach, how did you go about, you know, letting that go or putting that to the side? You know, I imagine you're a very driven guy. How did you go about transitioning into this role of a new type of coaching as the CEO of Striver?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, prior to coaching football, you know, I did my MBA at USC. I worked in consulting before that. I was fairly entrepreneurial minded. You know, consulting taught me a lot and you know, was good as a first job out of school, but it wasn't for me. I just kind of knew that, you know, pretty quickly. It wasn't for me over the long haul. So, ironically, we actually do a fair bit of consulting right now with Striver for our customers, which we can, you know, talk about later. But I did in prior to business school, and then in business school, I was pretty entrepreneurial minded. And so when I was going through business school, I was thinking to myself, all right, what am I going to do after school? I don't know if I really want to go back to a big company. You know, do I have an idea to start my own business? Well, then I have this thought that if I don't see coaching before I turn 30, I'm going to regret it forever. So yeah, when I went back, as you said, Chad, when I went back to Stanford to coach, I was planning on putting everything I had into being a coach. You know, at a very minimum, to decide whether or not I wanted to do it for the rest of my life, you know, after my 2 years there that I was signing up for. I really liked coaching. I there were a lot of things I really liked about it. There were also enough things that I didn't like about it that gave me pause as it related to thinking about if this is something that I wanted to do for the rest of my life. Well, when David sat me down and had the get the heck out of here conversation, I mean, he was giving me his advice, but he also said, but if you want to stay, like, I got a job waiting for you next year. So I had to do some soul searching, and I had to think through everything. And, you know, I think what gave me comfort in leaving coaching, at least for now, right? I mean, David also was very clear, hey, coaching, football's not going anywhere, but your window here of opportunity for this startup may go somewhere. Right. But I think what gave me comfort was there were enough things about coaching that I was like, yeah, you know, that I don't really like that. So it's not like this is the only profession for me on planet Earth, as much as I really like it. But really it was, okay, let's look at this opportunity right now with this startup. It's entrepreneurial, check. It's technology, check. It's sports, first and foremost. This is pre-Walmart, right? Check. It's David Shaw offering to give me a check for $30,000 to get off the ground. And if something happens to go wrong, I'm in back, you know, I have the Stanford network as my, you know, safety net. Right. So there were just a lot of stars that aligned. And when I kind of talked through this with my wife, my parents, it was like, if not now, then when am I ever going to start my own company? You know? So that was it. I mean, honestly, other than the daunting nature of going out and doing your own thing, you know, it was a relatively easy decision to at a minimum put coaching on pause. You know, maybe I walk, maybe it's for good when based on how my life plays out, to go ahead and do that. So it was the perfect storm of all those things coming together.
I love that. Derek, how do you think about the total addressable market? And I'm most curious to know, how did you think about the total addressable market for this at the beginning of your journey with the company to where you were at now, right? Because the market for VR is, it's large, but some might consider it small. But if we look at the market for education, it's absolutely massive in the trillions. So how are you thinking about that and how has it evolved over time?
Yeah. So one of the first lessons of entrepreneurship that I didn't pay close enough attention to in business school, but did once it was, you know, go time for real with Striver. We were moving so fast in 2015 with sports teams that I wasn't really thinking about market size. But then as the football season was kicking off and therefore the window of being able to sell to more football teams closed, you know, for 6 months till the season ends and they look at new products, we started doing some mental math. We're like, oh, okay, so we got this many teams this year. There are, what, 120 college teams that could maybe afford this. There are 32 NFL teams. Obviously, there's some other sports, but, you know, pretty quickly you do the math and you realize, I'm just making numbers up, like, if every team paid us $100,000 and we got, you know, half the professional teams and some of the college teams on planet Earth, you know, you do the math and pretty quickly you realize that's only like a, what, $8 to $10 million revenue business. Not to poo-poo that because it's really hard to get there, but it's certainly not a billion-dollar opportunity by any means. So, you know, along with the aha moment of Walmart and all of in 2016 and all of the similarities of sports versus enterprise from, you know, from a training perspective, the other aha moment was, you know, we decided to pilot Walmart in one of their learning academies. Well, they had 200 learning academies at the time. They have like 204. Yeah, they have like 212 now.
Sometimes so they had 200 Walmart's size of many nations.
Yes. Oh yeah. Okay. So yeah. So here we go. 200 learning academies. And then 4,500 stores in the United States. And they made it very clear from the first meeting, well, if this works in the academies, we would want it in every store. So I'm just doing the mental math on like the price of this pilot. And I'm like, oh my God, these guys could pay us more than every sports team on planet Earth combined. And they are only one of, you know, thousands of companies on planet Earth.
Definitely.
And, you know, lo and behold, that's kind of how it has worked out with Walmart. But I mean that, so there you go, right? Like there's your market size story in a nutshell. And then as we've just kind of had to go through this more with investors and even looking internally, you know, the third party market, let's take VR out of this for a second. This is Striver's less of a VR play than it is an enterprise software play. So the third party market for corporate training in the United States is $50 billion annually. And the amount of money that's spent on HR technology, when you actually go even more broadly than just the training part of HR, is $250 billion annually. So, you know, I mean, the old adage, right? Like get 1% of a massive market and boom, it's $1 billion in revenue. I mean, that's kind of where we're sitting right now. And so that is a very real thing. You never want to dominate a market that isn't very big. You'd rather get a small piece or hopefully a large piece of a market that's massive.
For sure. And I think one of the cool things too about Striver and what you're doing is it's in an established market, but at the same time too, you're kind of defining this new category and all the phrases that you mentioned earlier on with immersive learning, you're creating it, right? Like the language is there, but you're very much like steering the ship. So how are you thinking about kind of leading the industry when it comes to, okay, here's what we provide, here are the benefits of it? Could you walk us through some examples of here's how this works as opposed to how they were doing it before?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, we're definitely a combination of, as you just said, Chad, we're definitely a combination of category creation and category disruption, right? The creation part being this whole virtual reality thing, right? Like the world has seen VR in crude forms over the last several decades, but they've never seen this cheaper, lighter, faster era of VR that we live in, you know, right now. So certainly category creating as it relates to putting headsets on faces instead of watching videos, looking at PowerPoint, sitting in lectures, et cetera, so for that immersive learning experience. Category disruption, and answering your question directly, in that, you know, we are taking a fairly old, obviously very large, you know, very archaic in many ways, category of learning in the enterprise, where folks give lectures, have them read and write. You know, now they watch videos, they look at PowerPoints. You know, e-learning is kind of a bit of a misnomer, because it's just consuming the same information, you know, electronically versus in a binder or a book. So how much more effective is it really? It's not. You can just, you know, do it from anywhere in theory with an internet connection. So that is really the value proposition here, is, all right, let's look at all the current and older ways that you train people. Again, the videos, the PowerPoints, the lectures, you know, all that, the videos, and everyone in this room would agree that these are somewhat ineffective in many ways. Yes, we would. Okay. So now this headset, when you put it on your face and you go through learning immersively, you go through learning like a pilot, you know, uses the flight simulator. Again, learning by doing, it is X percent more effective, right? We can cut our training time by Y percent. That will lead to Z, you know, from an ROI standpoint. So it's a pretty simple exercise to walk people through. And what helps us is a lot of the learning professionals, HR professionals, you know, executives that we talk to, they've all been through their own training, and they don't like it. They, how fast can I click through this? Yeah. Am I still awake while I'm watching this video? Right. So VR is a very obvious improvement. And that makes our job pretty easy, you know, from a sales perspective.
And so much of that training too, you know, it feels like kind of this compliance slash you're static, you're moving through it. There are a lot of different ways that these trainings can be gamed, or where people can kind of zone out, not really pay attention. Whereas this, you know, forces some movement, some interactivity. Could you tell us a little bit more about the differences? You know, you've got sport teams using it. So how active is this? And walk us through, like, maybe some examples of your favorite trainings that you've seen.
Sure. So on the one hand, yes, you're absolutely correct. When you're immersed in VR, not only can you look around anywhere you want, you know, in front of you, behind you, left, right, et cetera, but also in some of the simulations, you can, you know, actually move your body, and with a controller, you can pick things up, you know, you can walk around, et cetera. So in that way, the learning is much more active, right? So from a cognitive neuroscience perspective, it's just way more effective. I mean, sometimes it's 10 plus X more effective, just based on what study you read, than passively watching a video, looking at a PowerPoint, et cetera. You know, our formula has been at Striver to date, and it's starting to change and evolve, has been more of the 360 video based training versus the CG training. And, you know, with examples being like an active shooter training at Walmart, a store robbery with Verizon, Black Friday training with Walmart was one of my favorite things we did with them. We've done certain safety things for FedEx, and, you know, the list goes on. So essentially with 360 video, you know, we're basically dropping you in to like a live action, real life scenario that you would be in the real world. And, you know, the end user takes it very, very seriously, and they're learning way more than they would if it was more of a passive experience. Now, the downside of 360 video is you don't actually move, right? So you can rotate, but you don't walk in the scene. You don't pick things up per se. So to do that, you would need more of like a 6 degree of freedom experience, you know, with object manipulation and more CG based. You know, the challenge with those is really twofold, at least today, and this will improve over time. Number one, they tend to still look pretty video gamey, and therefore people can tune out sometimes. And so they're not, your brain isn't as engaged. And then the second is they're not as scalable. And what I mean by that is, you know, you got to think about these corporations we're working with, right? Like Walmart stores, FedEx warehouses, BMW factories, Verizon stores, you know, they don't have a ton of space to just have people run around in VR, right? So like, right. It's really hard to scale a 6 degree of freedom experience where you're walking across a room or you're picking something up, because you know you're not going to have six people in a room bumping into each other necessarily. So that's certainly the future of where this is going as we see the workplace continue to evolve and companies to change manage their way for making more space for these things. But as of today, most of our training has been 360 video based, which allows people to just kind of stay in one spot, rotate. You can even sit down if you want, and you can have a lot of people doing it in one space at the same time.
Very cool. And when it comes to the data that you're collecting during these trainings, how does that work? And how is the data that you're collecting during these richer than some of the old alternatives that folks were using?
Yeah, so most of the data that we're collecting today, there are the basics, right? Like who's using it, what they get right or wrong on answers, you know, how long were they in there, et cetera. But most of the, and that serves a purpose for sure. But you can also get that with like e-learning. Did they get the question right or wrong, right? So most of the deeper analytics that we're collecting are related to attention. So where is this person looking in the scene? So they may have gotten question three correct, but they never actually looked in the direction of the thing that they needed to see to answer question three. Therefore, did they guess, right? Or is this question, you know, hard enough, right? So,
sure.
So we've been providing attention trends to our customers to say, hey, you told us you want everyone to look over there at this point in the training. Well, guess what? Only like 30% of your workforce is doing that. So either we're not training on it correctly, or like we got a bigger problem. No, that's what they're going to do in the real world. And we need to figure out how we're going to, you know, how we're going to improve that, or what we need to do as a result. So most of our deeper analytics focuses on attention. From there, you can kind of combine attention with, you know, time spent with in the experience, with reaction time, with questions and answers, to calculate what we call like an engagement score, which is super, super interesting as it relates to, you know, an engaged learner is a better learner. So let's tell you how engaged your employees are. And then eventually the holy grail, you know, back to our discussion from a minute ago, will be when you have like these really high-end 6 degree of freedom simulations and people are walking and they're, you know, building things with their hands. And now you're kind of putting all this together to where, you know, if you don't do it right in VR, then you're not going to do it right in the real world. And we can tell that to a customer. And therefore, we either don't hire this person, we don't put them out on the floor to do the job, you know, and everything in between. So that's something that we're really excited about down the road.
And you recently just acquired a analytics company. So walk us through that acquisition. Was that your first? And tell us about it. And how are you doing that integration?
We had actually done a couple acqui-hires over the last couple of years, just, you know, companies going out of business, and we kind of picked up the pieces. This was our first like real acquisition of Observer Analytics and their relatively small team. So we not only did we acquire the people, but also the code base and some things that they had been working on. And so far so good. I mean, we've been slowly integrating the code because we kind of needed them to just come in and work on some existing initiatives and get them up to speed quicker. And now we're starting to see, okay, what of what these guys built previously would apply to what we're doing. So we're starting to work on that this upcoming quarter. But so far so good. The folks that we hired, one actually came in and was supposed to do a certain role, and then we put him in another role, kind of in a pinch as a product manager for our data product. And he has just been crushing it from day one, with little actual experience for the role, which is super cool to see. I love those kind of diamond in the rough hires. The engineers that we brought on board have integrated in nicely. And, you know, we've probably moved faster in 4 or 5 months than, we moved in the previous, you know, 2 years in this area, which is super exciting. And obviously that's something that you want to happen when you make an acquisition.
So over these years of building the company, what have been some of the hardest moments for you, or have there been any dark nights of the soul, whether it's professionally or personally? You know, there's always struggles going on. Are there any moments where you feel like, okay, I want other CEOs, I want other leaders to know this?
Dark moments of the soul.
They're real sometimes. Yeah.
that may imply many, that we could go many places with that. I mean, listen, we probably could spend all day talking about, you know, challenges for sure. I would say like overall, just, you know, overall over the last 5 years, I do travel a lot, you know, from the sports teams originally to the customers, and I'm married. I've got a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old, and I make sure to be very present when I'm home. But you know, my first year, I probably spent 200 days on the road, then 150, and then 100, and probably like 85 last year. Obviously, right now is no one's traveling, so their mom and kids are very appreciative of me being around more. So that's very challenging personally. Being on FaceTime with your kids is no fun at all. My wife, it's easier on me and my wife, but the kids, it's tough. So that is not fun at all, but we know that hopefully it's temporary over the long haul. Professionally, honestly, there isn't one thing. I mean, startup life is a daily roller coaster, literally daily, sometimes hourly of highs and lows, right? We certainly have had our fair share of success over the last several years. I mean, it's been up and to the right. It's been a rocket ship. I constantly am reminding our employees that this is not normal. You know, what we've experienced, some of the deals we've closed, the rapid growth, especially to start with Fortune 1 in the enterprise, like this is just not normal. So everyone appreciate it and don't take it for granted. Right. So that has been awesome. I would say one of the, just for other entrepreneurs as well, I'd say one of the things that does kind of constantly torment me is pricing, and I think it's one of those things like, all right, if everyone's buying your product, is our price too low? If no one's buying our product, is our price too high? Is the price the reason no one's buying it? Okay, we're selling great. Are we leaving money on the table? Are we charging too much and we could have more customers? I mean, it's just this, it's this constant inner battle, right? And of course, all your customers are going to try to negotiate. So you never really know where they stand with what they're willing to pay. It's a constant back and forth. And that's something that I have come to accept. We will probably never get perfect. Right. In interviewing executives, especially sales leaders, over the years, like all of them that have a lot of experience say the same thing. Like, hey, Derek, I've told every one of my founders, we're going to screw up the first 6 to 10 deals here and on pricing wise. So it's just don't get too high or too low on anything that we do from a pricing perspective for like 2 years. And lo and behold, that's kind of how it's played out. So
that's so interesting. And it's a really, really, I think, important point, because it's one of those things, I think, as a founder, you don't want to have a new enterprise feel like, oh, we're not getting a good deal, or, the price is too high. And to hear that you're struggling with that is super, super reassuring. So when you are struggling with something like that and you're going about putting together a solution or, a new path forward, are you leaning on your board? Are there any go-to investors that you're bouncing ideas off of? Is it peers? How do you go about kind of triangulating a solution?
We're pretty lucky. We have an awesome board that is relatively hands-off and that they're not, looking over our shoulder all the time. So they let us run our business. They trust us to run our business. Obviously we've had, a track record of success. So that always helps to have that credibility. But I'd say that the big things, the big challenge we're working through, we do go to them. And we don't save it for a board meeting once a quarter necessarily. I'll just pick up the phone and call them or say, hey, I want to kind of get an hour of your time on Thursday and I can walk you through something. So I do use the board. Now the challenge with the board is, they're not in the day-to-day of the business, nor do they want to be or need to be. So sometimes some of these challenges are just too deep for even the board. So I'm very fortunate. We have a very strong executive team, not the most experienced team, and that we've all done 8 startups, with exits before, but, super smart, super motivated people, really just good people. And one of the things that we have really focused on here is, especially during this COVID time, like there's a time to move fast and break things for sure. But, let's also not be afraid of being deliberate and being thoughtful and working through things and challenges and coming at it from multiple different perspectives. And if something takes us 6 hours, it could have taken us, 6 minutes, but it leads us to a better outcome that we're all aligned on. Like, cool. It's all good. Right. So that's something that we take very seriously on the leadership team. And then lastly, I also have an executive coach and he also works with our whole leadership team and even some of our kind of like middle and senior managers as well. And he's been an outstanding sounding board for me over the last couple of years in many areas, and less of like, here's what I think you should do for as far as the decision, and more coaching me and the leadership team through the discussion process and the decision-making process. And, you know, here's a little tip for people too. I'd say 9 times out of 10, when I bring a problem to him or when we bring a problem to him, the first thing he says is, or asks us is, what's the outcome you're looking for? And half the time we can't even answer that question. And we have to say, what are we looking for here? What are we trying to achieve? Even for a meeting, right? An offsite. So what are we trying to achieve out of the next 6 hours? And just that simple question. And that's that 10 minutes of, you know, getting the bullets on the board. It's so stupid simple, but often it does help put decision-making into context for sure.
Yeah. And that perspective from people that have some distance and that are just not in the day-to-day can be invaluable. Yep. So when it comes to the market as a whole, are there any developments? Is there anything out there that you think is, you know, going to become normal over the next couple of years? Is there anything that you think is like an open secret? What is getting you excited about the future of virtual reality?
You know, I think there are two macroeconomic things happening that make me very excited. And then there's a few like reality checks too, which we can get to in a second. So everything that's happening in the world right now, with COVID and remote work and, you know, all this stuff, collaboration and all that, and people moving places and working from home. And it's just really good for our business and our industry, because folks that have been looking at VR for a while are now saying, okay, I'm done looking. I need to be doing this. So I'm ready. And they're calling us. Now, over the last 6 months, we've kind of seen there has definitely been a pause from a spending perspective while everyone kind of collects themselves with COVID, but that has changed and things are moving forward very quickly. So, macroeconomically, the tailwinds around how VR can be a solution for all of the current and future problems we're going to face with what's going on, that is just a home run. And that has me very excited. Then the second thing is Facebook, Microsoft, Google, Apple, Lenovo, Hewlett Packard. I mean, we're not talking a bunch of startups in a garage here investing in this space. We're talking, you know, behemoth enterprise technology companies. And, you know, I have certainly had my fair share over the last 5 or 6 years, maybe going back to your other question, you know, what keeps you up at night? Very, very little, but I certainly have had my fair share of like irrational fear of, oh my God, is the bottom going to fall out of this whole market? And are they just going to stop making headsets? Especially with kind of how we've seen the consumer market be a little slow. And, you know, time and time again, I'm reassured by outsiders, insiders, as well as just my own thinking. You know, when that list of names is investing billions of dollars in this space, like that's awesome. And it's not going anywhere. If anything, it's only going to get better.
It's just starting.
And we're like in the bottom of the first inning right now, right? So those are two things that have me very, very, very excited macroeconomically. As far as like any like new innovations or, you know, what are we seeing that's a game changer here in 2020? Nothing, you know, crazy from a hardware, software, et cetera perspective. I do think we're 5 to 10 years out from augmented reality being like a real thing. People want it to be Minority Report-esque. That's probably a decade or more away. On the VR side, certainly Facebook, Microsoft, you know, et cetera, they all want us, you know, living in headsets all day. And this idea of like, you know, the virtual workspace. I personally don't see it. I don't see us hanging out in headsets all day. They'd have to turn into a pair of swim goggles from an ergonomics perspective. And even then, I don't know. So I'm not one who's on the, we're going to do everything in life and in work in VR train. That's kind of not me. And that has not changed in the last 6 years, since people have been asking me my opinion about these things.
Which is refreshing because it gets back to the outcome thing where I would prefer we didn't. And many people would.
So too. Would I. Yeah. I don't want Minority Report. You know, I'm kind of low tech in my personal life, but
right on.
But what I do think unequivocally is, you know, okay, how old are you? You sound like you're in your 30s. Okay, perfect. So am I. I'm 35. So when you and I got our first jobs out of school, like they gave us a laptop, right? And before that, it was a desktop computer, right? So we've gone from you get a desktop computer to you get a laptop, to you get a laptop and a phone, to you get a laptop and a tablet and a phone, right? Or some combination. And I do think in the next 5 years, you're going to get a laptop and a phone and a headset. And whether it's for training purposes, whether it's for collaboration purposes, whatever it is, that headset is now going to be an integral tool to how you do your job. And it won't knowledge workers, task workers, the frontline, everything. And it's not going to be an all day thing, but it is going to be a part of the day thing. And there are going to be very discrete, specific things you do in that headset that is a better experience and therefore a better ROI outcome for the business than what you used to do. So that I do fundamentally believe, you know, while juxtaposing it with like, come on guys, let's be realistic. We're not going to spend all day in VR.
For sure. Yeah. And yeah, first job out of school, I got an M4, but I mean, it was a different yeah. situation, which brings us to some industry news about, so Anduril just won, I think, a $950 million military contract for some training, basically, in VR. So this is really exciting, I think, as we see DoD kind of start to lead the way here. How do you think about the future? You know, these are different markets. You started in sports, but you quickly got to the enterprise. Are you thinking about working with DoD or any institutions like that as well?
We have been talking to a number of different industries for many years, for the last few years, excuse me. Many would imply, you know, we're more than 6 years old. We're not. So, we get phone calls from everybody, you know, large enterprises, healthcare, DoD, education, et cetera. DoD is definitely something that I want to be doing more of in the coming years. But you also got to focus, as you look at the challenges we have on our plate in enterprise, again, I said this at the beginning of the segment, for us, it's less about virtual reality and more about enterprise software. And that means, you know, that means data, you know, data and security. You know, that means GDPR and CCPA and troubleshooting and all this other, and tech support, right? And the reports and the portals that, all this stuff that is just is so much bigger than putting the headset on. We are so proud of, you know, how far ahead we are of everybody else relative to enterprise requirements and being able to do this at scale within an enterprise. And we've got 22,000 headsets out in the field. We've trained over 1 million people. I don't think anyone's even one hundredth of the way as far along as we are, you know, in the space. I'm saying that objectively, not arrogantly. So like that, we take that very seriously, and we want to double down on that lead in the enterprise. And while DoD has a bunch of awesome use cases, for example, DoD has a bunch of awesome use cases and, you know, certainly is a massive market as well. You know, getting FedRAMP certified is what, 2 to 3 years, you know? Sure. So like we have to just weigh that against all of the other things that we have to do. And so while we have dipped our toe in the water on the DoD front, you know, going all in on DoD is something that we need to take some time to think through exactly how we do it.
Wise words. And you mentioned reality checks earlier. What type of reality checks do you think are coming in the industry, or that more people need to be aware of?
Well, we've already mentioned a few in this conversation. I don't think we're going to hang out all day in headsets. That is not something people want to do, definitely with the current form factor and you know, even as it goes onward. This idea of what we just talked about, enterprise, you know, security requirements, you know, DoD requirements, you know, I know the $950 million contract sounds big, but the devil's in the details, right? And so is there a bridge from a grant to that takes place over 10 years? Like, is that company, you know, FedRAMP certified? You know, we saw Microsoft with the big HoloLens deal several years ago with the Army. And then we read recently that the Army's actually like giving the devices back because they don't work out in the middle of Afghanistan. Well, no duh, you need an internet connection out there, right? So like there's just like when you start to peel back the layers of you know what it actually takes to pull this off, you know, there's still a long way to go. You know, we're still in the bottom of the first inning. We're just getting started, as you said. And then, you know, some of the other reality checks that we go through with our customers, again, go back to this word scale. And we're constantly talking to customers And they're like, hey, like, why is your price this? And so-and-so's price is this. And it's, you know, three, you know, one third. And we're like, well, that's because you're just buying a piece of content and you're just buying something fun from that other vendor. Like, how many people do you want to put this through? Well, we want to start with like 500 and then eventually want it across the whole company. Oh, cool. So like, how are you going to do that? Like, how are you going to scale it? How are you going to put it on headsets? How are you going to collect data? Who's going to do the customer support? On and on. You know, how are you going to go? Does that company, can they do the IT assessment that you require that's 48 pages long? It takes 9 months. And then they start going, oh yeah, you're right. Like, I think we need to be working with you. Well, yeah, we know. So, and I'm not saying that to insult any of these other companies. It's just the reality. Like, this is just what it takes. So, you know, we feel that we are very well positioned to win over the long haul. And Chad, when I do sales meetings, I literally talk to customers like I'm talking to you, because I just want to educate them and inform them. And I make it very clear, hey, if we don't work with you, it's cool, but I don't want you to fail, because then that's bad for the industry. So here are the 8 things that you need to be thinking about. And if that other vendor you're going to work with can't do them, you either need to work with us or not do it at all and wait until you're more ready, right? And the industry is more ready.
Awesome. Derek, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for sharing. And if there is anything you would leave our listeners with, you know, I'd love to hear it. We have a lot of folks that are excited about VR and everything that it's bringing to the table. So if it's a final thought or maybe one of the coolest anecdotes that you've come across lately, would love to hear it. The mic's yours.
I mean, maybe my reality check a second ago was a little sobering, bordering on, you know, negative/realistic. On the positive front, very positive. Here's a reality check. This stuff works. I mean, this is not snake oil. So from a learning and development perspective, and you know, I get it. VR is cool, but is it really going to be a thing over the long haul? It freaking works. We have done the studies, you know, and as of third parties, you know, not us, that have corroborated this. You put someone side by side, 20 minutes in a headset versus, for example, an hour in front of the computer, 3 hours in the lecture, whatever, right? The old way. And they learn the exact same amount of information, if not more, in the headset. So our customers are achieving a similar, minimum identical, at best even greater, of a learning outcome in a fraction of the time.
Powerful.
So there you go, right? I mean, like that is the pitch in a nutshell. And it's pretty easy from there.
I love it. Derek, thanks so much for your time, and to everyone listening, we'll see you next time.
I'm Sophia Bush, and you've been listening to Hidden in Plain Sight from mission.org. This podcast is sponsored by our friends at Splunk, the Data to Everything platform. In today's data-driven world, every company, big or small, new or old, is sitting on terabytes of unused, untapped, and unknown data. Splunk helps turn all that data into action. Using cutting-edge AI and machine learning, Splunk delivers real-time predictive insights that will help you on your mission to change the world. With solutions for IT, security, Internet of Things, and business operations, Splunk empowers people to make faster, better decisions and take action to get things done. It's time for our data to be more than a record of what happened. It's time to make things happen. Check it out at splunk.com.